Welcome to the Up the Cream podcast 2022 episode 16. I'm Dan Tomlinson, joined as always by Rich Harrison, aka Pommy Rich. How are you doing, Paul?
Yeah, I'm well, mate. How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thank you. After another good win at home. Five in a row, Hull 48 to lose 12. Not satisfactory at worst. I really enjoyed that. Good win.
Yeah, very much so, yeah. And that's the highest score being scored against them all year as well. So we put them to the sword, which is good to see.
Yeah, absolutely. 48-16 against Salford won it. So technically that is our biggest win, biggest margin, 48-12. Some good tries on show as well. Some really pleasing moves and nice to see some free-flowing rugby. Nice to see Hull pull away from an opponent as well and put them to the sword and show that they've got some points in them and show that they've got, you know, a decent attack in them with pace, power and speed.
Yeah, absolutely. When was the last time? I mean, all I've seen is the tries, because that's the highlights that have been posted. But how nice is it to see a Hull player take someone on the outside and burn them for pace? That's a lovely sight, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's Hodgson's direction, up the Brett Hodgson revolution. It's all about youth, it's all about pace, and we've got an abundance of both at the minute. So yes, yeah, start right there. Connor Wynn, hat-trick hero. Second hat-trick of the season. He's now Hull FC's top try scorer this season. What a performance yet again. And the fact he just comes into the side, again after missing a week because of the HIA protocols, and then comes back in like it's absolutely nothing and produces another worldy performance. What a temperament that young man has got. He's turning into a fine young player.
Yeah, and he's been coming a while, hasn't it? And I think we said a couple of weeks ago, it feels like he's been around a lot longer than he has, because, you know, he had a game or two 3 years ago, and then a game or two 2 years ago. And then, you know, it's only really last season and this season that he's actually had an extended run in the first team. So, you know, I think he's still under 25 games for Hull, but he just feels like he's been around a long time. But no, it's great to see, mate. It's really good to see the youth policy kind of bearing a little bit of fruit. And we've got a talent there. We've absolutely got a talent there.
Absolutely. 24 games, to be precise, 12 tries, seven this season with seven tries. So he's, you know, he's 1-for-1 ratio. And obviously, yeah, every time he comes into the side, no matter if it's a 2 week gap, a 3 week gap, a 4 week gap, whatever, he just produces the goods. And I think it's a point our, get his name right this time, Damo, mentioned a couple of weeks back, and I give him the credit for it again, because it's a really good point. And yeah, it just shows again the temperament that he's got about him. But you know, he's obviously one that fans are talking about right now. He's obviously a local lad, he's come through our system, he's obviously the first pick this Cityville Academy regime. They picked Mickey Lewis over the river. We got Connor Wynn, and to be honest, I think we made the right decision, because he's made that centre position his own. And to be honest, he's making a case now, and it's a big call, because obviously Josh Griffin's a senior player, he's been around the block, you know, 120 odd games for Hull. But he's making a case now where it's his spot to lose. Honestly, every time he comes in, he's a threat, he's a nightmare to deal with. As you say, he's got pace, he goes round players, he's elusive, he's got a sidestep, just a box of tricks.
Yeah, and he's strong in defence as well. You know, the one thing I would say that Griffin probably brings that a lot of other players don't bring is those metres out of backfield, you know, the first couple of carries in a set and stuff. But at the end of the day, Griffin's getting older. We've had a really good run out of Josh Griffin. You know, Carlos is in probably he's probably this is his last contract.
Yeah, because it was a 4-year one, wasn't it? So yeah, I think you're right there. Yeah.
This is his last contract. So, you know, when you've got Connor Wynn and you've got Scott waiting in the wings as well, who, you know, was injured at absolutely the worst time after giving the best 40 minutes of his career, he gets injured and, you know, and then has to sit out the rest of the games where he probably would have been first name on the team sheet because of the way he'd been playing, and because we had Carlos out and because we had Griffin out. You know, we've had Vuli Kijipani playing there. You've got Wynn and Scott should be our centre partnership for years to come.
Absolutely. They're the faces that Hull FC have to build the future around. They should be the absolute forefront of the club for years to come, and I'll extend that to Jack Brown, to Jordan Lane, to Brad Fash, to Joe Cater. It's obviously the young hooker, Devine Bamford, that came on at the weekend. You know, your Ben McNamara, your Jacob Hookums, your Davy Littons. That's what the club have got to be building the future around. But and that's interesting itself, because I saw a lot of people on social media talking about Connor Wynn being out of contract. Well, for a start, he's not out of contract. Hull FC have a club year option, which they can activate, and then Connor Wynn is a Hull FC player for 2023 at least. Then, you come to the back end of next year, Josh Griffin's out of contract, you maybe then say, okay, right, you're going to move up to the pack, or thank you for your service, pending form and fitness. Conor Wynn then gets a boosted extended deal, and you got to forget, we can't forget that Conor Wynn has played 24 games so far. That's all he's played in the four seasons that he's been a first teamer. So by then, you'd like to think he'd be approaching or topping 50 games for the club, and then he warrants that big deal, doesn't he? You say, right, okay, you're my main centre now, with Cam Scott, hopefully, and obviously Carlos Tumavaiva will still be knocking about then. So, you know, that's the direction we've got to go in, but we've also got to be patient. It's good to see that Hull are obviously putting that time and effort into the youth right now, because, you know, when you see Super League right now, you see so many players get suspended and injured, and they go to this, like, emergency loan market, and they'll bring someone in. Wakefield did it, didn't they, with Morgan Escure a few weeks ago. But we haven't done that. No, we could have done it with a halfback this weekend, but we didn't. We just put Jordan Johnson at seven. We put the young 18-year-old on the bench. I really like that. We've never panicked. We've just put Cam Scott in, or you say we put Conor Wynn in. And they're actually not just filling up numbers in the first team. They're absolutely thriving. And, you know, you've got to trust the club here. That's my point. That's my overall point here. Trust the club. He's got a year option. That year option will be activated. Cam Scott is out of contract this year. That's one that is. So you'd like to think that he'll be extended too. Let's just trust the club and see what happens. And, you know, they'll have more room to play with next year. We all know that. We've obviously the wheeling deal, and that's to come. And if it's a case where we sat down this time next year and Conor Wynn warrants a big Hull FC deal, then I'm sure the club will sort that out.
Yeah, agreed. And like you say, there's no rush at the moment. I mean, the only one really that's urgent in all of the players that you just named is probably Scott. I'd really like to think that we'd offer a decent deal to and keep him, because I think he's had a fractured start to his career with a few injuries and stuff, but I think he showed enough in the first couple of games of this season that he could be anything. He really could. And as he's maturing, and he's maturing mentally and physically, he could be a very, very, very useful centre. You know, he's a future Great Britain international, in my opinion.
I don't think that's an over the top shout, really. Look at the back end of last year, and that's what I'll base these opinions on as well, because obviously Cam Scott has only played three games, obviously, before he rolled his ankle and out for two or three months. So I'll base it on what we saw last year. Cam Scott got a Club Player of the Month award. Him and Wynn and Manu Mao as well finished the season as all's best three players. I know that's not a mean feat, given we lost 9 out of 10 to finish the season, but facts are facts. Can't go away from those facts that Cam Scott was one of all's best players. Definitely wants a deal. There's definitely potential there, and he's starting to maximise that potential as well. And I suppose there's a key lesson there for all of us, isn't there, about being patient and persevering with youth. And we've seen it with Brad Fash. You know, he's well over 100 games for the club now. He's looking the part every week. We've seen it with Jack Brown. He's played, 34, 35 games now. Looks the part every week. Jordan Lane's closing on 100, or will be at the end of the season. Again, he looks the part. You know, unfortunately, Joe Cater's had two horrendous injuries, but whenever he comes in, he never lets us down and adds to the side. So that's the direction, and I don't think we can emphasise that point enough. And Hodgson's coming, and it's been an absolute breath of fresh air seeing that, and seeing his brand of rugby, and seeing that he prefers pace over speed, and he likes the slender, the slicker players. And we've seen examples of that right throughout the side. You know, Daniel McIntosh has come in. Hat-trick on the weekend, he was outstanding. But it's not just the try scoring. I mean, the first one was fantastic, airborne, you know, one of those freakish athletic finishes that the wingers seem to do these days. But it's his work rate out of backfield that really gets me, you know, quick play of the balls, gets us on the front foot and gets our sets rolling, and literally runs over a mountain every single week for this club, does Darnell McIntosh. He's been outstanding. But it's that pacey direction, that slicker direction, that youth direction. That's what I love about Hull FC at the minute. You know, win, lose or draw. And it's the long game, isn't it? It is definitely about patience, and I think I don't want to shout it too loud. And you know, we're 11 games in, and you know, we did the similar podcast last year, and it all fell away. But right now, really content with it. I really am.
Yeah. I think fourth in the league when we've played more than half of the games without our first choice seven, and probably half of the games without our first choice six, with, you know, players missing, players season-ending injuries. You know, three weeks ago, we were saying that our best player was, what's his name in the pack? Andre Savelia. You know, and now he's out for a season-ending injury. You know, it was great to see Cater back, and he was looking like he was getting back into form, season-ending injury. You know, we're fourth in the league, and we've done it through adversity. You know, That's incredible. That's really, really, really good. There's a lot of improvement in us. And like when we went to Rovers and lost, you looked at that team and you thought, that's about as well as they can play. And that was about as bad as we can play. We get a run of form. And, you know, St. Helens in a couple of weeks is a real acid test. And then Wigan at home after that, that's a real acid test as well. It'll show you how far we actually have come. But we're at the stage of the season now where we've played every team at least once and we're fourth. Wow. And that's without our halfback and without our 5-8 playing 50% of the games. And without Carlos, who you'd say was our best centre, and without Griffin for large portions, and without Swift for large portions. Wow. You know, bloody hell. Fourth. That's unbelievable.
Dizzy height territory, that's what it is. It's something that I would have absolutely bit your bloody hand off for Brad Nash there at the start of the year.
If we were sat here fourth after winning 7 from 11 in the league and our halfback had played every game and Reynolds had played every game and, you know, we had Griffin and Tumavavi in the centres and we had a full pack and all the rest of it, we'd be going, yeah, job done, that's great. That's really good. But we've done it without them.
Mm.
That's phenomenal.
It really is. It's a key point that definitely needs emphasising. And it's easy for us to do that as fans. But I'll tell you what, while I'm on my little Brett Hodgson, you know, song and dance, one thing I love about him is he don't sit and whinge all the time saying, no, you've got this bloke out. He'll give the injury updates when he's asked the questions, obviously. But he won't sit and whinge in his pressers about A, B and C or that playing. He'll talk about the A, B and C that are playing. And
yes,
this is something that he did this week. He said, rather than focus on who's out, look who's in. You know, look at Manuel Mal, outstanding. Look at Joel Overdue stepping up at 6. What a signing he's been. Ever present. Scored again at the weekend. Could have scored another one. One of my mates called Ash had Joel Overdue tribe race at 55-1 with a 5 run. He was absolutely raging when he did that. Proper under 60 stuff though. What a pass into Kane Evans at the end. But I saw the funny side of it. Obviously laughing at my mate's expense. But yeah, you'd be absolutely raging, wouldn't you? But as daft as it sounds, isn't that like a nice little thing that there's sort of like a little bit of cohesion now? Yeah, I'll get my mate over the line. You know, I could have scored myself and plonked it down. But I know, big Kane, he's coming for a bit of criticism. Oh, let's get him a try. You know, I kind of like it. It's, you know, obviously... it's a proper kid's move.
You can guarantee that in the sheds afterwards, people are going, ooh, Fiji friends.
Yeah, in between us. Ooh, friend. Yeah, absolutely. That was, 100% would have happened. But yeah, I did like that. And honestly, Lovejoy was outstanding. You know, another thing, right? People say, oh, yeah, it's only to lose. First of all, that's disrespectful. To lose have more than held their own in at least half of their games this year. Let's not forget they lost to Wigan by a point. They lost to, you know, the Harlem Globetrotter Entertainers by 4 points on Easter Monday. You know, they beat St. Helens's, some will say St. Helens's A-team, but they still beat them. You know, obviously, you know, they've had games where they've only just come up short by one or two scores. So for us to actually put a score on, which is actually our best, but also their worst, you know, their biggest defeat of the season, it's pretty telling, to be honest. And the fact that we've done it, like you say, with some big earners sat in the stand, and we've done it with players that are shining that we wouldn't have expected to be at the forefront of this side, you know, at the start of the year. I think it's all boxes ticked. It all, you know, adds to the satisfactory start we've had to the year. And as I say, that's the fourth time now, if you include the Salford game, the Leeds game, obviously Sheffield in the Cup, and this one here against Toulouse, where we've pushed away from an opponent and, you know, racked up some points. And we've got to be content with that. We've also ground out wins, you know, obviously Wakefield on the opening day, the two against Warrington Easter Monday, Catalans the Sunday after, Huddersfield in the league a few weeks before that. You know, that's 4 wins we've ground out as well. So it's good that we've got that, you know, the ability to do both, to actually blow teams away when we're on top, but also to stick in the fight when needed and show other areas of our game. Because, you know, rugby league's not just about doing all the fancy stuff, innit? It's about the tough nitty-gritty stuff as well. And I'd said last week we've got to meet in the middle, didn't I? And I think, obviously, against Toulouse, we did that. And that will remain the challenge going forward.
Yeah, and I think we're learning. We're learning that there are some games that you can cut loose and there are some games where you can't. And that's an important lesson. And that's a lesson that Rovers haven't learned, because they're trying to cut loose in every game, because that's the only way that they can play, because they haven't got the strength down the middle. They can't beat a team in size, so they've got to try and play around teams, which is great. That's what the West Tigers did in 2005. That's how they won the comp. They had the smallest, lightest pack I've ever seen in the NRL, but they went around teams because they were quick. That's what Rovers are trying to do, arguably, right now.
Could you argue that cost Cass? Sorry to jump in there. Could you argue that cost Cass a grand final win in 2017?
Yeah. You probably could.
They were the best team in the league by a mile, weren't they?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But, you know, if you play like the Harlem Globetrotters and that's all you've got, when you come up against a team that wants to grind and you can't get around them because you're getting beaten down the middle and your halfbacks can't get the ball out and your hooker can't get the ball out because you're getting beaten down the middle, well, then you've got nowhere to go. And, you know, for Rovers who have, you know, we're fantastic, we're playing a great brand of rugby and blah, 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 to go to Leeds and get nilled against a Leeds team that have been awful and a Leeds team that had 10 players out injured, that just goes to show you, you know, this, you know, you have a section of our support that go, oh, you know, yeah, we won, but bloody hell, it was boring, it was terrible. You know, when we ground that win out against Huddersfield, we ground that win out against Wakefield, first game of the season, you, oh, it's a grind, it's a grind, it's a grind. Well, it's bloody 4 points there. There's 4 points there that another team wouldn't have got and that we wouldn't have got last year or the year before, but we're getting them now. And then it gives you the right to cut loose against a team where you can cut loose, you know, when you realise that the Salford team have come and they're not all that, then you do cut loose and put 30-odd points past them, 40 points past them, and you do that to Toulouse. And when you go to Leeds and you realise that Leeds are abject and that you can throw the ball around, then you do it. But you've got to earn that right. And unfortunately, there's been a couple of instances where we haven't earned that right and just tried to do it. But I think they've been learning experiences. That game against Cass, certainly the game against Rovers when we were playing very lateral, I think we've learned. And, you know, at the end of the day, mate, 7 wins from 11. And 2 of the games that we've lost, we should have won. So, I'm more than content.
I think perception is probably the word there. We've mentioned this a few times this year, but you look at what was expected of Hull at the start of the year. I'm not talking about our fan base here. I'm talking about outside of Hull. So you would believe, you know, your media medleys and, you know, opposition fan bases. No one would have expected Hull to be in the top six. Everyone would have had them probably eighth or ninth. I mean, I thought sixth at best, didn't I? I think you said fifth or sixth, didn't you? So you were slightly more optimistic than I was. But no one had Hull in the top six. Everyone labelled Hull a side that were boring, you know, decent pack, but no flair, no finesse, you know, no pace. Well, how wrong are they? Because Hull are changing perceptions right now. As I say, four teams that they've blown away. 3 in Super League, okay, 1 was a Championship side. But I won't disrespect them. We saw what happened in that Challenge Cup round anyway. You know, we got more points than Saints did at Whitehaven, and we got more points than Huddersfield did at Barrow. So there you go. You know, we're definitely changing perceptions right now. We've got some outstanding rugby league players. Don't get me wrong, we've still got some flaws, we've still got some limitations. I think we are going to have to polish up our 6 and 9, and our 7 and a 9, one of the two. I've been very consistent right through the past 18 months about that. I'll stick to my guns on those two positions. But we've got some outstanding players elsewhere in this side. We really have. I mentioned the youth ones, but again, you know, the best pals off the field. But Chris Sattai, Liggy Sow were absolutely immense again. Liggy Sow was actually incredible. And yes, people say again, it's only Toulouse, but this isn't a one-game thing. This has been happening for weeks on end now. We did the same thing against Catalans, who run us up last year and finished first in the table. Sattai again was a wrecking ball. Manu Mao was incredible. He was nothing short of phenomenal. And it, you know, Tongan Terminator, he obviously came to the club. It was announced midway through 2019 as a massive, you know, blockbuster NRL signing. We got glimpses of that before COVID struck. I thought that Catalans game where we threw the lead away, you know, he put Sam Tompkins on his backside. He looked absolutely outstanding. Then the crowd started calling Tompkins a wanker. Tompkins turned into Prime. Sam Tompkins did what he'd done best and won the game for Catalans. I'm definitely patting in the face that one. But honestly, Manuel Mao has got better and better and better in a Hull FC jersey. I think sometimes I didn't like to use the COVID thing as an excuse. You know, we're the first team to obviously contract that in 2020. Then we had a huge shutdown outbreak at the club again last year, didn't we? And we're talking a good month here, aren't we? You know, we're not talking just a week shutdown. We're talking a month-long shutdown. So I don't want to use it as an excuse to our fortunes in both of those years, but it definitely played a factor, and especially for a player that's obviously moved his family, you know, all the way over here from the other side of the world and had to settle in and, you know, get used to new environments, you know, new relationships, new surroundings. And I think it does play a part, but now that he's actually having some continuity, he's been injury-free, you know, and hopefully touch wood will remain so for the foreseeable. Looking absolutely the part right now, he really is. Strong runner, He's got an offload in him. He's got a, you know, flick and trick in him. He's got a big hit in him. He's also got a bit of gas when he breaks through as well. The try for that, obviously, Bamford got on his debut was all from a man who now line busted an offload. So he's got everything in his package right now, and he's absolutely a revelation on that left edge.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I remember when we did sign him, he had two of the absolute best games of his career immediately after signing for Parramatta, and he was amazing. There was a game where I remember on the radio, actually, I was driving somewhere, I was listening to it on the radio, and somebody said, "Yeah, I can't believe that he's going to Super League when he's in this kind of form." You know, it's just, how can we not keep him in the NRL when he's in this kind of form? And, you know, because that's the general perception of Super League, is that it's a retirement village. But, you know, he was very, very good. And when he came to hold, you know, situation, like you said, with COVID and, you know, starting a new thing and everything, I thought he started fairly slow, but boy, has he grown into it. And like you said, end of last season, probably one of our best players, certainly the best forward. And this year, I think he's been brilliant. I really do. I think he's showing us what we always thought we'd get, which is a little bit, you know, like when we had Sikamanu, you got a lot of grit and a lot of hard hitting in defence and some drive, but Manu runs wide and he's got a bit of pace. Does Manu Mao, and he's a bit more. He's a bit more silky skilled than you were expecting, I think, when you see a bloke who A, looks like that, and B, that size. You know, he's actually got a fair pair of hands, and he's got a good offload. And, yeah, I mean, you know, he's coming to the end of his contract, and I would not be unhappy at the moment to see him get another year. And I know me and you especially have talked about players going on that extra year that they probably shouldn't have and all the rest of it, but I honestly think that he's worth it.
If you're basing it right now, 100%.
Yep.
If he gets another, because he is prone to the odd, you know, the odd hamstring or the odd calf, as a lot of our players seem to be at the club. If he gets another one of them and he's out for, I don't know, 6 to 8 weeks later in the season, then I'll probably have my doubts again. Because, you know, he's obviously a big earner, he's a senior player, he's a big forward on that edge for us. We need him playing, you know, at least 75% of the games, you know, per season.
Yes.
If he continues in this manner of form, then absolutely, yeah, get him signed for another year. And I don't care if he's 34, and I don't care if I said we can't go on making the same mistakes over and over and over again. Because I look at this player right now, he's adding to Hull FC, he is getting on top of his opposition. But not only doing that, he is skittling his opposition week on week, whether the Catalans, whether the Toulouse, whether the Warrington, whether the Huddersfield. He's, like I say, he's been brilliant ever since he's come back into the side. Obviously, not forget, he had obviously a pre-season injury, didn't he? So he was late coming back in and hit the ground running straight away with no pre-season games, barring a little run out against London at Loughborough. So really, 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 really pleasing with Manu Mao at the moment. I wouldn't be against having him for a year at all. You've got to go on the individual, haven't you? And obviously form and fitness play a big part in that. And it is a brave call. I'm fully aware of that. And it's sort of like we're sort of like crossing that line, aren't we? Where we're sort of being a little bit hypocritical in what we said about players before. But Manu Mao in 2022 is playing a lot better than Mark Minicello was in 2018. I'll put that out there now.
Yeah, and you've got to look at it. You've got to look at it on a case by case basis, haven't you? On a player by player basis, there are some players that are finished at 30. There are some players that carry on to 36. As long as he's fit and as long as he's like you say, playing more games than he's not, yeah, I'm happy.
He was a late starter as well, wasn't he? Don't need to go into
very
why.
Late,
we all know why. Yeah, we don't need to go into that. So he's a late starter, obviously given his chance by Brad Arthur at Parramatta. So he hasn't had that mileage into his body. Yeah, exactly. So
he only ever played for Parra.
Exactly. Yeah. So he hasn't had that mileage, say, like a Liam Watts has had. You know, he's played 30 games a season since he was 18 years old. Manu Mao hasn't done that. Maybe there will be some, you know, some miles in the legs still. As you know, I say, he's 34 now, but you've seen players can go on to 35, 36 and still win grand finals and still be big parts of, you know, of top clubs in both the NRL and both and in Super League as well. So I don't necessarily have an issue with it if we did sign him on for a year. In this form right now, how can you not? I mean, anyone who was there, you know, at the Alphabet Spaghetti Stadium on Saturday was in awe. And to be honest, it came off on about 71, 72 minutes, something like that. There wasn't anyone still on the backsides when he came off. Everyone gave him a standing ovation. That's, you know, the level of appreciation that was in the crowd when Manuel Mal went off. So, yeah, absolutely worth another year for me. He's been nothing short of incredible recently. And
good.
It's a senior player, isn't it? That's the thing. We talk about youth, we talk about pace, we talk about, you know, that direction, but you've still got to have your experience. We talk about mobility, but you've still got to have size. I think we had a rant, didn't we, after we got beat by St Helens, where we said all needed is, you know, one or two more big blocks in the middle. Now, hopefully, we've got them with Kane Evans and Scott Taylor back. It's the same now with experience. And I think you do need that type of player on your side. He's someone that, you know, others follow, because he's a leader. He leads by example. You take one look at him and think, yeah, whatever you want, man, whatever you say. Yeah, you want me to come through that brick wall? Yeah, okay, I ain't going to argue with you. Scared the shit out of me.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that point bears a little bit closer inspection as well, because, you know, we've been saying about our pack and about how we've been rolling over teams and everything, but we've been doing that with a short-handed pack, really. But now we've got Kane Evans, who is getting better week to week. And now we've got, you know, Mao firing on all cylinders. And now we've got Taylor back. And then you've got your other guys still to kind of, you know, you've got your Bowdens and your, you know, you basically, you know, although you haven't got Savelio and you haven't got Keita, you know, they've had their part to play this year. You know, and then you've got your younger players coming through that can fill a gap. We've actually got a very, very impressive pack at the moment. We've got a pack that other teams are scared of. We really have, and that's a really good thing, because it's been a while. It's been a while since, you know, when we had Watson, Taylor absolutely terrorizing defenses for a year and a half, 2 years. But that's kind of, we moved away from that, because obviously Watts went and Taylor's been kind of winding down because of injuries and stuff. So it's nice that we're back to that. And Sow and Satai and Manu, Mao and Taylor as a foursome in that pack, with, you know, ably assisted by your Fashes and your, you know, and your Jordan Lanes and people like that. Wow, we've got a great pack.
We've got a monstrous pack of forwards that, if we play the right way and find that middle ground and go forward and go direct and play when we're in the right, so we have, you know, definitely, as I say, got a pack that can, you know, put the life of fear into oppositions. We really have. I can always whinge about our flaws and our limitations, and I can moan after this defeat saying this bloke didn't play well, this one did my head in, this style of play did my head in, you know, especially as we did against the Derby, because it was Rovers and no one likes getting beat by Rovers, but you can't beat around the bush. It was bad. I even had my mate Kevin Deaton moaning after that game, and he never moans. He's one of these that'll, you know, he'll go regardless. He won't necessarily tear his hair out, probably because he's got none left. He won't mind me saying that, but he's not one to, you know, I tear my hair out. I get real emotional, especially the first 12 hours after a game. It can dictate my mood for the rest of the weekend. It really can. And Easter Saturday after Rovers, I was fuming. I'm not going to lie. I spent all good Friday night being miserable. I was fuming on Easter Saturday. Probably calmed down a little bit by the Sunday. And then obviously after we beat Warrington, I was like, oh yeah, a bit more content now. But that's what it does to you, the Ulan Rovers thing. And I think there's a lot of people like that on both sides. And the moods will be dictated, especially when we get beat by them. It's a nightmare. I hate it. Nothing worse. But yeah, I think, as I say, we've got some outstanding players at this club, and it's just about nurturing and persevering with them, you know, on the young side. But obviously, you know, maximising them on the experience side as well, and you know, getting those last few bits of miles out of them. In Manuel Mal's case, and obviously Chris Satai's case, Liggy Sal's case, obviously been brilliant. And you know, there's a lot to go at, and you know, we're half an hour in. We haven't even mentioned Jake Connor yet. He popped up with 3 try assists. That's 16 in the season now in Super League. He's played one game less than most players as well, and he tops the comp for try assists. Wow. Yet apparently he's off the pace and not good enough.
Yeah, some people.
I understand some the game. People. The game obviously has a lot more about it than just putting tries on the plate for the opposition. But that's the main part of the game, isn't it? How would you beat an opponent? Well, you do that by putting points on the board. And there's no one better than Jake Connor for doing that. He's, you know, more try contributions than any other player in Super League this year, if you take, you know, tries as well into consideration. So, Yeah, I don't get it. I really don't. I actually think the defensive side of his game is improving a little bit. I think we've seen him in recent games, especially obviously it goes hand in hand with the nitty gritty performances we've seen from Hull. I think we've seen that side of the game step up a little bit. He's running the ball back. Yeah. I noticed that Hull's back three, they go to the middle. You know, whether it's a winger picking it up on the flank, they'll always run to the middle. And some people are like, oh, go forward. But it's all about setting your players up for, you know, play 2, 3, 4, and 5. It's not getting pinned in the corner. You know, like, remember, that's what we did so well with Catalans. That's why we restricted their meters, because they were coming out the corner all the time. Hull like to get away from that and play through the middle, because then you've got options at each side of the player ball. It's that simple. And I do think that side of his game's improving. Don't get me wrong, there's still, you know, further improvement to come in that department. He probably won't look back at Toulouse's second try with much fondness. Whether they actually got that down or not, though, I'd still put a doubt in that.
Yeah, it did look a bit dodgy, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, overall, I think that side is improving. And don't get me wrong, Connor's not been at his blistering best, which is daft to sound after he ran the show and it was a pleasure to watch and he gets 3 tries this year again. But you sort of look at how he was at Leeds, you look at how he was in that Salford game, and you're thinking, wow, that was such a ridiculous high level. And he probably hasn't reached that enough times since. He'll probably be the first to admit that. But you look at Jake Connor overall, look at his contributions to Hull FC week by week. He's contributing to every single win we have. What more can you ask for?
Well, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I think to your point as well, mate, you know, you can't expect him to be a superstar every week, because not every game's going to suit his style of play. You know, and it's your absolute superstars of World Rugby League that can actually go out there and influence a game and bring it around to being their type of game when it's not. You know, you're talking about the very elite few. You're talking about your Andrew Johnses or your Lockyers and people like that, who can actually take a game that's been a bit of a grind and inject a massive amount of class into it and turn it into something completely different. And I don't think there's many English players that can do that at all, never mind Jake Connor. And I just think that when we win in the forwards and when we're rolling forward, and then he can choose where to put himself on the pitch, and he can pop up on the left, pop up on the right, pop up in the middle, then wow, you know, we've got a wonderful attacking player. The one thing that a lot of modern fullbacks do that Jake Connor doesn't is that backing up around, you know, players that make a break. Mm-hmm. And that is something that your very, very quick fullbacks do. That's like your Duff, Matt Duffy does it in the NRL. It's what other players have done for years. You know, you're quick. You know, Ben Barber does that a lot. You know, you're really quick backing up, supporting fullbacks. Now, Jake Connor's not got the pace to play. He's got fair pace, but he's not got the electric pace to be one of those, to be a Slater, you know? So he doesn't play that way. We don't play that way. He's not the player that's backing up a break. To be honest, a lot of the time, your player that's backing up a break is your hooker or your halfback or your 5/8, actually. It'd be Reynolds that'll back up a break rather than Connor. Whoever's playing at 6 is the one who's backing up the break, the way we play. And it just allows him that little bit extra time and gives him that bit more energy to be able to just go, you know what, I'm going to pop up on the left-hand side of the ruck this time instead of the right-hand side. You know what, I'm going to pop up 3 out. I'm going to be between the second row forward and the centre rather than coming further infield. And, you know, he's not right every time, but more often than not, he pops up in exactly the right place. So, you know, I am not at all displeased with the way that he's played at all. I think this year he's been a revelation.
Yeah, when you look at some of the stuff Jake Connor's done this year, the highlight package is enough to fill 10 minutes already. And as I say, we're you know, just over a third of the way through the season, if you like, 11 games in. He's an incredible player. And I think an important factor is that he's only actually played fullback for 1 1/3 seasons. It's a point I've made a few times on this podcast.
Yeah.
I remember Sam Tompkins' first year at fullback, and people at the time were comparing him to in prime Zach Hardacre at Leeds for the England jersey. It was 2015, I believe. It was around that era, and there was a big debate from fans across Super Leagues. Obviously, you know, it gets people talking. You know, talking internationals here. We had a Kiwi series at the end of the year, Four Nations year after. So England, you know, it was back in the day where they actually played in Australia, actually came over here, you know, Halcyon days.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, having And I say, we're having a debate every week pretty much, and Hardacre was favoured a lot of the time because of his defensive traits over Sam Tomkins, even though Sam Tomkins was twice the attacking fullback than Zach Hardacre was. And you look at Tomkins now, he's improved the defensive side to his game so much that he's probably on a par with peak Hardacre 2015. So that's the point here. Just been joined by my cockaboo, apologies for that. But yeah, he's, that's the challenge for Jake Connor. He's obviously played the fullback position for literally 15, 16 months. He will get better in time. That's a fact. You've got to persevere again with him. We say that we've got to persevere with Youthful. We've got to persevere with Jake Connor at fullback as well. And the attacking elements that he brings to the table are nothing short of outstanding. I'm confident that in time, the defensive side will come. It will. And especially with those around him as well, because that's a key point. And it's something that, something actually the three Kiries mentioned when they came out to Hull on Sunday for the dinner at the Hilton. And they said that the 80s success was built on a team camaraderie, the fact that everyone was willing to stand up for each other and literally defend your mate next to you. And I think Hull will get there eventually. I think we're seeing signs of it now, out with that camaraderie, that cohesion within the Hull team right now. I think they are a tight-knit unit. Brett Hodgson spoke as much recently in the media, which is pleasing to see. And you know, if we do get that, then that will bring individuals on as well as the team too, and it'll definitely help Connor. That's the overall point here.
No, I think you're right. It's there's a long way to go, and there's a lot of improvement in our spine and in our structure and in the way that we play, and that can only come from our 1, 6, 7, and 9 playing together, or any 1, 6, 9, and 7 playing together for an extended run of matches. And you know, Connor's had a couple of games out, and he's been injured, and we've had to put someone else there. You know, you've got Gale missing more than 75% of the matches that he would have been eligible to play. Reynolds missing 50% of the matches he was going to play, and you know, and Houghton playing most of them. So you've got your 1 and your 9, but your 6 and your 7. Do you know, your fullback never wins a game on his own ever. He wins a game because his hooker's got his forwards going forward, and he's got his halfbacks chiming into the line and allowing him to dictate where he wants to inject himself as an attacking threat. And that can only improve if we get the same 1, 6, 7, and 9 playing. So, you know, at the moment, again, I'm going to go back to that same point, mate. We've had a disrupted season. We've had some weird selections that we've been forced into. You know, who'd have thought Joe Lovadua coming to the club would be playing in the halves, playing in the centres, playing at 6, playing at 9, playing at 13, playing in the second row. He's been playing everywhere, and you know, and playing fantastically well. We're fourth after having some weird and wonderful team selections, the spines all over the place. We've got weird people, you know, got hookers playing at 6. You've got Jordan Johnston playing at 7. You've had, you know, it's just all over the place, and we're still fourth.
Yeah,
and a lot of that is because Connor has been mercurial at fullback and needs to carry on being mercurial at fullback.
Yeah, absolutely. The disruption point and the lack of continuity are two key factors that we've all got to take into consideration, and they both sing Hull FC's praises, the fact that they're fourth on the table right now. Let's just hope we're still seeing these things in August and come September. It's the long game, isn't it, with Hull FC? It always is. We started really well. I think that's a fair reflection now. It's about carrying on for the rest of the season. Hopefully we can do that. Kiwi dinner then, obviously three Kiwis, Gary Kemble, Dean O'Hara and Fred O'Coy, came back to Hull this weekend. They're still in the city now. They're back at the KCOM for another event, or MKM, sorry, for another event next weekend. Just a shout out to James Lowell. I obviously couldn't make it due to ill health. It was announced back in the last year that he has the early stages of Alzheimer's and dementia. So best wishes obviously go out to him and his family. But, you know, to see the others, you know, Gary Kemble, Dean O'Hara, Fred O'Coy, was really humbling actually. And one thing I noticed, that the connection between those players and the supporters is still as strong as it was 40 years ago. And I think that's nothing short of incredible.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's always nice to say, and you know, it's what I've said to you before, when I've met ex-players over here, and everyone always describes Hull as a family. not a club, a family. And back then, in the mid-80s, when we were at the peak of our powers, it was a family. It really was. And you know, it was very, very smart of Arthur Bunting to sign all three of them together. Because, you know, you sign one or you sign two, there's a possibility that you get a little bit homesick or whatever, but he signed three great mates who became greater mates while they were over here. And then Fred Okoye, who was part of that group as well, came a couple of years later. Now, let's not forget, Fred Okoye was one of the players that Bunting wanted, but he was under contract to North Sydney Bears and we couldn't get him. You know, Bunting was really after Okoye, Luluai and O'Hara. Kemble was very much an afterthought. Kemble had played a season in 79 for Hunslet. And hadn't particularly set the world on fire. But when we made the move to sign O'Hara and Luluai, it was very much, do you mind if our mate Gary comes as well, kind of thing. So we more or less bought two and got one free, almost. And Kemble probably proved to be one of the best fullbacks we've ever signed. I mean, he slowed down a lot at the end, but we had 3 years of him when he was probably the world's greatest fullback at the time. Luluai was phenomenal and the greatest stepper and one of the fastest players I think I've ever seen, and Dan O'Hara was pure class. And then when we got Fred Okoye, we thought, oh great, you know, we're getting this fantastic standoff, but he was as hard as nails as well. And I think most people would have seen that footage of I think it was Len Casey had a go at him in a Hull derby after Rovers had actually won the comp and 1985 they'd won the championship, and then we went and played them the week after they'd lifted the trophy and we beat them, and he had a go at Fred Okoye, and after he put one punch on Okoye's chin, Okoye retaliated with about six before he could even raise his hands again, Len Casey, and Casey got sent off.
That was mentioned yesterday, then, he got a standing ovation for it.
good and then Casey, if you remember, pushed the touch judge away and ended up getting banned and not going on a Great Britain tour to Australia because of it. So he really screwed him. He really screwed Len Casey up, did Fred. And, mate, honestly, great memories. For people my age, I grew up with those three, four players, and with Sterling and Muggleton and you know, some of the English guys that we had, you know, your Crookses and your Nortons and your Schofields and everything. I'm blessed to have grown up in that era.
So anyone who's read the latest Up the Cream will obviously have read your outstanding blog. Just give that a little plug there about literally what life was like growing up in Hull as a kid throughout the early 80s. Can you just elaborate on that now? Because, you know, you're talking the absolute pinnacle of rugby league in Hull, where not just us, but also them lot over the river were also literally at the top of the game. And they both, for a good 2-3 years, actually ruled the rugby league world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've got to look at it through the prism of what was happening in the rest of the world at the time. And that's what I wrote the blog about, was, you know, Hull was, you know, we're in the middle of a Thatcher government who, and you know, no matter what your politics are, and I'm not going to get political, but that Tory government of the early 80s, anything north of Oxford, they completely ignored. They let the north go to rack and ruin, and they had the miners' strike, and the fishing industry had gone. And Hull was a very, very, very economically depressed place. It was not a pleasant place to try and find a job. I remember my dad being unemployed for large portions of that time, and it wasn't a particularly fantastic place. And it was, you know, depressing and horrible, and the place was falling apart. There were still parts of Hull that were bomb sites that had never been redeveloped after the Second World War. This is fully like 40 years later, after the Hull Blitz. It was a pretty depressing place to grow up, but it's through all of this crap, somehow, our two rugby league clubs were the two best in the world. You know, Hull and Rovers were the very pinnacle of the game. They were absolutely, it was something for the town to be proud of, something for the city to really be proud of. And, you know, people were skinting themselves to go to Wembley, you know, from both sides of the city. In 1980, when we all went, you know, it was phenomenal. And you know, you've got a city that was barely known for its soccer, which is the national sport, but was known around the world for its rugby league. You know, and I think the example I gave in that blog was, you know, when I was playing football with my mates, you know, on the school field or whatever. I'd never pretend to be a Hull City player. I'd always pretend to be Ian Rush or Kenny Dalglish or Kevin Keegan or whatever, because they were the big players at the time. But if we ever played rugby league, I was always going to be Peter Sterling or you know, Lee Crooks or James Luluai or whatever, because they were my heroes and they were people that I could see if I walked down the street. And that was a huge thing as a rugby league fan, as a kid. And that's why my age and people late 40s, early 50s, that's why Hull have got such a large proportion of supporters in that age group, because they grew up and got absolutely bitten by the bug. And we've all suffered for it since, when we've had teams that have been crap and we've had seasons of hurt and portions in the second division and all the rest of it. But we're all dyed-in-the-wool Hull fans. We're all tattooed, or we're all, you know, we've all got a massive collection of Hull shirts, like Dan O'Hara's got that he showed in that photograph. Because we grew up in that magical time, just an absolute accident of birth, I happened to be there right in the middle of it, and I found my lucky stars because I saw some phenomenal things. And it's really, those guys are absolutely in the middle of that. Bunting signed, went around the world and signed some fantastic players. He signed some crap as well, by the way, but he signed some good players. And, you know, I'm forever thankful that I had some amazing nights at the Boulevard and around the north of England, watching some of the absolute best players in the world at that time, or since, playing for my club in the Irregular Hoops. You know, it's just, it was a phenomenal time, it really was.
Yeah, I love listening to stories from that era. And on the other side of the fence as well, I do like the fact that fans are blinking enough to say that, oh yeah, it was absolutely incredible, we're the best thing since sliced bread, blah, blah, blah. My dad, yourself, Ian Freshers of this world, all say we should have won more, given the money that we threw around and the squad of talent that we had. And actually, a couple of the Kiwis said as much yesterday. They said, we were blessed to be in 13 cup finals, but they actually said, and this was a direct quote, we should have won more of them.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we should. You know, and it's little, you know, the world turns on these tiny little things, but, you know, Wembley against Featherstone, we should have won that game. We absolutely should have won that game. We got absolutely mugged that day. And with, you know, I think Kevin Harkin got injured, and David Topless was absolutely cutting them to pieces from standoff. But because Harkin went off injured, we had to put Topless on the scrum rather than at first receiver. And it just stifled him. And it just brought him closer to Featherstone's pack and Featherstone's defence. And he just stifled him out of the game. And it was just awful. You could see it coming a mile off. I mean, even at the age I was there, I could see it, you know. It was just, you know, the game against Wigan at Wembley in 85, we could very, very easily have won that. A couple of Premiership finals we should have won, you know. We could have gone on a better run in the Cup. And again, it was always those stupid games. It was games against Rochdale or games against Halifax, the teams we should have been beating that we ended up, you know, losing by narrow margins, and that came to bite us by the back end of the year. It was a great time. It was a really frustrating time as well. But the great thing was that because Rovers were right up there as well. I mean, when Hull have had periods of dominance and Rovers have been in the second division, it's great, but it's not the same. It's good when you can grind your opponents into the dust, especially when they only live over the fence, you know, which is great. And they'll think the same of us as well. You know, your success is even sweeter if your nearest and dearest neighbours are there to see it in person, you know. And, you know, that's why they still crow on about 10-5, because, you know, they beat us in the biggest game of the year at Wembley, which is fair play to them, but terrible for us. You know, and, you know, after that we beat them in Yorkshire Cup finals, and, you know, we pipped them to the Championship, and then they pipped us to the Championship. And it was just an amazing time to be a rugby league supporter in our hometown. It really was. And you're right, both teams should have won more. But, you know, the other teams around us at the time, it was really Widnes and then a little bit of Saints and a little bit of Wigan that were the opposition. Cass were okay. They won a little bit. Leeds went particularly fantastic back then. Bradford were nothing back then. You know, Halifax, Featherstone managed to jag a couple of bits and pieces, but it was really Hull, Rovers, Wigan, Widnes with the absolute, you know, powerhouses of rugby league back then.
Great time and a great era to be a Hull FC supporter, and just to finish off there, the standing ovation and the cheering when Steve Norton finally got sober enough to get onto the stage, and the level of noise, you know, we're talking, what, 35 years-ish since he last pulled on a Hull FC jersey, and to get that reception, I think, says it all.
He's different gravy, Steve Norton. And you know, a real proponent of that, you know, work hard, play hard group, if you want to call it that. You know, he loved a beer, he loved a drink, and if you've read Lee Crooks's autobiography, you probably know a little bit more about Steve Norton than I'm willing to kind of put onto a podcast. But you know, I've never seen a player like that before or since. He's just incredible. And what a bloke as well, and a real cheeky, you know. I remember going to an ex-players function years and years and years ago, and someone stood up and said something, and Norton grabbed the microphone off him and said, "Yeah, and then you signed me, and we started winning, didn't we?" He's brilliant, you know. I love that. So,
about right, though, isn't it?
Yeah, dead right, 100% right. Yeah, that was probably the best signing we ever made, because he was the catalyst. You know, when we signed him, we were half a season in Division 1, then went down to Division 2, and you know, there were players playing for us in Division 2 that were legitimately international class players playing in Division 2 when we won 26 games, and Norton was a big reason that a lot of other players came to the club. He was the reason that Sammy Lloyd came to the club. He was the reason that that the Kiwis, you know, you're going to be playing alongside someone like Steve Norton. They'd tell you that it was a massive deciding factor when they saw that the players that'd be playing around as to why they came to Hull and didn't go somewhere else. Absolutely.
Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant times, brilliant era. Moving on then, the Super League card this weekend, six results. Wakefield 12, Huddersfield 14, Warrington 22, Wigan 40, St Helens 14, Salford 10, Leeds 18, 12, Harlem Globetrotters 0. Caradans 44, Cast 12, and obviously our game, Hull 48, to Lowe's 12. I think the points there are just to re-emphasise what we said. Warrington, absolute basket case. You know, we talk about perceptions. Castleford getting stuffed by Catalans a week after we turn them over. Again, perceptions. You know, the best of Hull on the road this year is how Hull Kingston Rovers marketed their side. Well, okay then, whatever you say, boys. Yeah, perception. I think that is that's the buzzword this week. And the perceptions on those three sides and the perception to Hull FC right now, well, it's Hull FC that currently sit outright fourth in Super League, and it's Hull FC who are ticking along all right.
Yeah, I'm interested to see what Rovers do squad-wise for the semi-final as well, because they've got a few players out and they've got players that filled HIAs that I think they're trying to kind of sneak through the net, aren't they? And it'd be very, very interesting to see what kind of a squad they actually put out against Huddersfield.
Likewise with St Helens, they've had a couple of niggly injuries, a couple that kept them out in the Salford game, and a couple more since then as well. So, yeah, obviously two semi-finals this week of the Challenge Cup at Elland Road. You know, for the good of the game, I hope the two belting cup ties, I hope they're, you know, well-supported, obviously, on television. I hope the BBC gets some good ratings. I hope everyone tunes in. And, obviously, I hope all Kingston Rovers lose. National Rugby League, then. Obviously, another interesting and action-packed round of action.
Oh, God, to say the least. Broncos 16, Sharks 7 was the Thursday night game. Very much billed as Talakai against Stags. Because of the way that Talakai had taken Manly apart the week before on his own, the centre. Stags 1-0, basically. He was incredible. Every time Talakai got the ball, Stags was right there in his face. And Broncos were very good value. It's a game that screwed a lot of people's tipping because the Sharks have been very good this year. But, wow. That was it was one of those games that they never really looked like losing, the Broncos. I thought they were very, very good. And again, a very good performance by Adam Reynolds. Titans 4, Panthers 18. I think I messaged you halfway through this and just went, I said you'd lose against a terrible team. But because they were 4-0 up, the Titans, for a while. But Panthers were in second gear for a long portion of this game, and then just when it mattered, put the foot down enough to get past the Titans. Titans weren't bad at all. They worried the Panthers, I thought. But that late Luai try just absolutely absolutely killed off any lingering hope that the Titans had. There's a bit of problem at the Titans. They're still insisting on picking Kevin Proctor in the second row, who his stats this game were, I think, 20-something tackles and one run for 4 metres. That's not sustainable. He's got to go. He's got to be dropped. And a lot of Titans supporters are very, very upset with what's happening, with him constantly picking Proctor. South 40, Manly 22. The Lawton send-off, which everyone's probably seen, was a terrible tackle and he deserved to go.
Absolutely.
It meant that Manly played... Yeah, it was awful. Manly played with 12 men for, well, best part of 70 minutes and actually worried South. So at one point, they went ahead early second half before it just told. I think South just ran over the top of them. That extra man really did tell. The Warriors, 21-20 winners over the Canberra Raiders. Taxi for Ricky Stewart, I think. He's got to be on borrowed time after that. It was a Sean Johnson field goal in Golden Point extra time after Lodge from the Warriors basically laid down in the tackle and said he'd been crusher tackled and managed to win a penalty right in front of the sticks with about a minute to go when the Raiders were 28-18 up. And Lodge has come out afterwards and admitted that he wasn't injured at all. He laid down to get the penalty, which is disgusting. Lodge has got other problems as well. I mean, there was obviously the assault charges and everything that Lodge was part of a while back, and he'd always kind of rehabilitated his reputation a little bit, but that was an awful, it wasn't a good look. And understandably Ricky Stewart was blowing up Deluxe in the post-match press conference, but you know, by that time you read it in the papers, it's done. Bulldog 16, Roosters 12. Take about Trent Barrett.
Wow. What for a while down.
He engineered a fantastic win there. We've been saying, I think I said a couple of weeks ago, you know, there was a game where if Joey Manu didn't play, the Roosters would have lost. And then I said last week that Joey Manu played and he was terrible. He was terrible again. 5 runs for a centre. 5 runs in the entire match. And he found himself up against a couple of classy opponents. Josh Adokar scored 2 great tries. The Bulldogs struggled home, 16-12. And a better team would have absolutely taken them to the cleaners. I thought Luke Thompson was very good for the Bulldogs, though. And 16-12 winners, and they were pretty good value for it. Eels 4, Cowboys 35. It's probably the worst I've ever seen the Eels play. They were terrible. Carl Felt got a hat-trick for the Cowboys. The Eels were terrible, terrible, terrible. They just did not cope with the conditions in Darwin. It was very hot, very humid, and the Cowboys just took them to the cleaners. Talking of being taken to the cleaners, Melbourne 50, Knights 2. So Melbourne have now scored, 140 points, 130 points now or something in 2 games. Coates hat-trick. Justin Olin was amazing. The Knights were terrible. At one stage, Ponga just refused to go for a loose ball. He just stood there and watched it. It was very, very poor. Newcastle scored 46 points in their first 2 games, and they've scored 46 points since those 2 games.
So 46 in 2, then 46 in 6.
In 6.
That's shocking.
That's pretty bad, isn't it?
Dead last now, aren't they, as well?
Dead last year on points difference after Melbourne took them to the cleaners. And then the Dragons 12, Tigers 6. Really hard fought game. Not a great game. Tigers could have nicked it in the end, but just kind of ran out of steam a little bit. It was a poor game, lots of errors. Gildart was okay, I suppose. Dropped a little bit of ball, but made some decent breaks. But yeah, Dragons were fairly good value for 12-6, and Ben Hunt again playing very, very well for the Dragons. Now, just going back to Melbourne quick, I just wanted to have a quick chat about the way that they seem to sign players from other lesser underperforming teams and fold them into that Melbourne system that we've spoken about at length, right? I won't do the forwards, I'll just go 1-7. In this game against the Knights, where they humbled the Knights. And this is the same 1-7 that humbled the Warriors last week, right? Pappenhausen started off at the West Tigers, never broke first grade. was always in the reserves, made a couple of 21-man squads, never actually played for the Tigers, signed by the Storm. He's now probably the best fullback in the competition. Meaney won the Wooden Spoon with the Bulldogs. Remus Smith got 15th last year with the Bulldogs and has never done anything other than that. Justin Olam, Papua New Guinea Hunters in the Queensland Cup, never played first grade before he came to Melbourne. Coates won the Spoon with Brisbane. Munster is the only Storm junior in that list. He was in the Queensland Cup with a couple of teams, but he's a Storm junior. And then Jerome Hughes, one game for the Titans, one game for the Cowboys, 3 years apart, released by both, gets picked up by Bellamy, and he's probably the best halfback in the comp right now.
Behave, Nathan Cleary. Anyway, yeah, go on. That's better.
He's the second best halfback in the comp right now. So, you know what I mean, though? They're getting players that have either been released, got rid of, you know, not been fantastic at their parent clubs or their previous clubs or whatever you want to call it. And they've turned them into a team that can put 50 points on another team, 60, 70 points the week before. It's unbelievable. Meaney and Remus Smith, you know, two players on the left edge there, both with the Bulldogs over the last couple of years. Terrible and terrible. The Bulldogs were leaking points last year and the year before. They've put them in Melbourne. They've just grown an extra leg. It's just, you know, Xavier Coates, yeah, or he was probably the best player in a poor Brisbane team, but won the Wooden Spoon with Brisbane. You put him in this Storm team and he's scoring hat-tricks for fun.
I think it's
just amazing.
Two words we mentioned a lot last year were system and process. And the Storm's system and process is the best in the world. I would counter that with Penrith. If Penrith have a few more years where
they need to sustain it.
I'm getting at. Yeah, obviously the Storm have been, you know, it's like, you know, how many years we always say if you're at Pucks saying this is the year that they finally go away. You've been doing that for 7 years now. They never do they? Because the organisation that they are is absolutely outstanding. They're always up there. So, yeah, if Penrith can sustain that, then, yeah, maybe they could be put on the same pedestal as the Storm.
Doesn't it say something, though, for players wanting to play for your club?
Absolutely.
Right? Penrith are doing it slightly differently. So Penrith are doing it because they've got a junior, they've got a nursery, and they're bringing players through. All these players here would have, when they found out that Melbourne were interested in them, would have absolutely jumped at it, right? Absolutely jumped at it. And they're cherry-picking from teams that aren't doing great and going, he's good, yeah, I can see something in him. Compare that to the players that have left Melbourne to go to other clubs as genuine superstars. You know, Nico Hines, you know, Ado Cars, you know, people like that have left Melbourne and gone. And then, you know, they're the best player in a poor team now. And, you know, you got other players going, oh, we want some of that Melbourne magic. We'll buy one of them and see if we can get it rubbed off on us. And it just doesn't work that way, does it? But then, you know, for some mental reason, you know, we've had it with us where we've had a team of all talents that has fractured because of, you know, financial constraints or salary cap or whatever. We haven't been able to keep hold of someone because a bigger club's wanted them and they've gone somewhere else. We've never been able to recycle it so that we get someone in that might not be as big a name but ends up being as good a player. That's been our problem for years and years and years. But when you look at what Melbourne have done there, you know, Meaney, Remus Smith, Olam, Coates as a back line with Pappenhausen at the back, Munster and Hughes. You know, there's Meaney and Remus Smith and Olam really aren't that big a name, really. They're not big names. Coates, yeah, possibly. Munster and Hughes, big names, and Pappenhausen has made a big name of himself. That's phenomenal that they can do that and just pick players out of other teams and just go, yeah, you're the one. And then they just seem to just get 50% better as soon as they put on that jersey. It's brilliant.
It is. It's a credit to them. It really is. And
you know, I hate them.
It's easy. They're easy to hate, aren't they? Absolutely. It's jealousy, isn't it? It's envy.
Yeah.
I pray to the gods that... You know, sound like a Game of Thrones lord there, praying to the gods, praying to the seven. But if Full FC can meet in the middle there with their system and process that they're trying to bring through now with the academy and complement that like Melbourne do with signings, both, you know, good players, you know, famous players, if you like, and obviously the fringe players that come in from nowhere, like your Joe Lovejewers, you know, people like that, your Chris Sattays.
You know, arguably, you know, we've done that with signing Connor and McIntosh from Huddersfield. you know, a team that's not as successful as us, but the players have grown an extra leg when you put a black and white shirt on them, which I think is true for both of those players.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. McIntosh can be anything he wants. Jake Connor, again, at, what was he, 27, going on 28, he can be anything he wants as well. So, but, you know, plenty of time. And it's plenty exciting. It is. It's exciting to see what we can do. I think, obviously, that it's the two P's again, though, isn't it? It's patience and perseverance. Obviously, we're comparing Hull FC to literally the best rugby league organisation in the world.
I didn't quite do that, but yeah.
No, I know what you mean. It's just, some people are like, ooh, yeah, but yeah, I don't know. I get excited with all this, with what Hull are trying to do right now, and it's why I'll keep banging that drum until I bore people to tears, because it's been the components of every single success story on both sides of the world in the last 20 years of rugby league in a salary cap sport, where if you get your system and your processes right within your academy and you can fill your squads with academy produced players, you're there. You know, you're more than halfway there. We've seen it with St Helens, seen it with Wigan, as much as it pains to say it, we saw it at Leeds, didn't we, with Yacine Fielder, Burrows and Maguire. Seeing it with the Storm, and we've seen it with obviously Penrith Panthers right now. Well, literally 95% of that squad is locally produced talent through their pathways. So if we get it right, it's exciting. And I think we've already got four or five, certainly, who are in that 17 right now at LFC on merit alone.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Agreed.
Obviously, the challenge is to keep going and keep being patient, and hopefully the performances will keep on coming, because I always refer back to podcasts that we were doing at the start of last year, and we're so happy with obviously what Brett Hodgson came in and implemented straight away. Obviously, we saw that with Jake Connor at fullback. We saw it with the power of starting Chris Satai. We saw it with the revelation that was Adam Swift on the wing. And this year, you can say that's been the same. You know, Ligi Sal's gone with Chris Satai, Manu Mawaz as well. And you're looking at Dino on the other side. We've got two absolute whippersnappers on the wings. You know, we've got young players who are coming through. The challenge for Jack Brown was to step up. He's more than done that. Yep. You know, same with Connor Wynn. Yeah, exactly. Yep. We've unearthed a gem there. Yeah, I really like to say we are going in the right direction. And don't get me wrong, we always said that this year was going to be a prelude to transition. There was going to be some ups and downs, and there was going to be some results where, you know, we're questioning that direction. And I think a really key quote is what Brett Hodgson said 3 weeks ago, and he said, we've got a plan, and it's important that we don't deviate from that plan regardless of results. And that's what I'm trying to do with my whole FC opinions right now, you know, win, lose or draw. I like to think I've been pretty consistent at what I expect and where I feel our strengths are and where we feel our weaknesses are. And I've always maintained that I think our strengths outweigh our weaknesses, so long as that we get, you know, our attitude right, so long as we get our consistency right, and as long as we get our brand of rugby right, with, you know, with the direct approach and obviously the, you know, the all guns Hail Mary cut out pass approach. And I think if we do meet in the middle and we, as I say, stick to our guns and stick to our principles, I do think we'll be there or thereabouts. And you know, when I say that, that's obviously there and thereabouts for our own goals this year, which are obviously being a playoff side. If we can do that, then yeah, I'm a happy Hull FC fan.
Agreed, me too.
All right, we'll leave that there for another episode of the podcast then. Got you some homework this week, haven't we? By request from our listener and up the cream writer, Tim. A list of every single out-of-contract NRL player.
Oh, bugger off.
Fulker. Oh, one key word. Bloody hell, one key word I missed out there. Apologies. Every single out-of-contract. Yeah, your homework this week, every single out-of-contract.
Do we need one if Bamford's playing well? I'm just trying to get out of doing my homework.
like every school kid. He's 18 years old, isn't he? It's a lot of pressure to put on a young kid, but is Lover Dew going to step up to the plate at 9? We don't know yet. He has at 6, it goes without saying. It's interesting, isn't it? It's very interesting.
I'll have a look.
Tim will be fist pumping right now somewhere in the south of England.
No worries. Yeah. Good stuff.
But yeah, as always, mate, thanks a lot for your time, and come on, you all.
Absolutely.